front row up on the left side, and we'll start now. Yes, sir. Press in here. And let's do it as quickly as possible so we won't impose on these gentlemen. Okay, and in view of the fact that members of the press have sat in on the panel discussion, we will open it for questions now. We do ask that you direct your questions to specific individuals. We're not going to have lights for this, that's why. Mark Bloom of the New York Daily News.
Dr. Wise, did I get the impression that you... you don't believe in the Ringwood theory of the Saturn rings or Saturn-like rings at all?
No. Let's make it clear. I think it's too early to judge clearly among any of the theories. They all have their Achilles heel. I simply pointed out the Achilles heel of this particular, or one of the Achilles heels. All of them have their difficulties.
Other questions, Ed DeLong?
I would like to ask Dr. West to follow up on that and say whether any of the theories have more Achilles heels, or try to rate them in order of the number of Achilles heels that they have, or the
whether
any have less.
You're dealing with a biased witness. It's obvious that depending on your basic discipline, you will be more impressed by one set of evidence or another set. For instance, J.F. Gordon MacDonald is very good at celestial mechanics and is very impressed with capture mechanisms. The geochemists go their route. I'm fundamentally a structural geologist, and I have to account for the set of geologic features and the sequence of features that I see on the lunar front and back. And to me, fission from the Earth is the easiest way of accounting for this sequence of events, the geologic history of the moon that we get by photogeology. So I'm most impressed by this mechanism. So I'm sure that every member of the panel here will have a different set of prejudices on these.
Harry Peace.
Is there any evidence in perhaps magnetism in the long-lived rocks and so on that we've had the necessary twist in the Earth's axis to move the moon to where it is now?
I think that the comment that Professor Ringwood made a little earlier, that internal motions in the Earth could alter the axis of the Earth, needs modification. You see, the Earth's spin axis in the solar system cannot be altered by internal motions in the Earth. And the objection that Goldreich has put forward to the idea that the moon formed from a dust cloud around the Earth appears to demand a movement of the axis of the Earth in space. And I think this must only can only come from outside due to some interaction between the angular momentum of the dust cloud around the Earth and the Earth's angular momentum axis.
Well, I would like to comment briefly. I think there are other possibilities. We believe that on this model that the Earth has lost a massive primitive atmosphere, the Earth may well have been coupled magnetohydrodynamically to that atmosphere. There are ways in which the Earth may have transferred angular momentum to the escaping primitive atmosphere, and there is no guarantee that the Earth's magnetic field was strictly symmetrical with its axis of rotation. I think there are just a number of complex phenomena here which we just haven't got much of a tie on yet. I grant the problem, but I think that the situation is so complex that we certainly can't say that no solution exists.
May I take a try at that tilting of the axis? I think Goldreich has very clearly shown that the present tilt of the lunar orbit, which is about 5 degrees to the plane of the ecliptic, had to be larger in the past. That when the moon was in at about 10 Earth radii, it had to be about twice the present inclination. And that the torque of causing this lunar orbit to precess through time is a torque on the Earth, and this is what's tilted the Earth's axis from about 10 degrees tilt at that time to its present 23.5 degrees. So this much of it seems reasonably well established. When you get inside 10 Earth radii, it's all up for grabs. It depends pretty much on your theory, then, of origin, what happens in close to the Earth.
Mark, well, I'm always sort of interested to see that no matter what evidence comes back from the moon, it exactly mirrors a given theory that a man has had before the evidence has come back. Does it strike you gentlemen that perhaps there is something less than objectivity in interpreting this information from Apollo 11?
It's commonly said that most of our thinking consists of finding reasons for going on believing as we already do. And I think this is true. It's a mistake to give up a theory too quickly. You want to be certain that there aren't errors in the data that's being cited or ways around it.
There's an old scientific law that says the theoretical possibilities will always exceed the appropriations.
I don't like the note of cynicism which has crept into the discussion in the last 2 minutes. I do think that it is obvious that while it's something a very small area of the lunar surface, many of the theories of the origin and evolution of the moon have been obtained by considering certain what we might call global aspects of the moon, which are very well based, and I think that one shouldn't abandon ideas that have been built up on data which is very well based concerning, for example, the celestial mechanics of the moon, simply by observations of one small area of the surface.
Well, I certainly agree. I think there is a large element of subjectivity. One attempts to, one has certain preconceived ideas, and one attempts to explain what one sees in terms of those ideas. But of course, when one finds that one can't, then one modifies and develops the hypothesis still further. Now, in this particular case, in 1960, I suggested the simple form of the fission hypothesis, that is, that the Earth, when the Earth's core form, that the rotational instability set in due to the decrease in moment of inertia and increase in angular velocity, and that the solid part of the Earth's mantle was thereby spun off to form the moon. And at the same time, the primitive atmosphere was dissipated by the same mechanism. As we got information, further information and further understanding of the probable chemical processes that went on the Earth, my ideas changed substantially, and I developed a different, a modified form of this proposal, which I've outlined already. But I see this as a development from the fission hypothesis. I don't see any fundamental conflict. Let's say I think that these are two closely related hypotheses, the simple fission hypothesis and the atmosphere precipitation hypothesis, largely dominated by the chemical conditions, the temperature which was involved. And there are all sorts of variants that one could imagine right now which would connect these. And I think one just has, as the evidence comes forward, as we now have in the case of the moon, one just has to evaluate these possibilities.
The old objection to the fission theory by Jeffries was concerned, of course, with the internal friction in the Earth in the process of fission. And I think one of the very interesting problems in the solar system at the present time is that wherever you look, you come up against the problem of the non-elastic behavior of the material of the planets, and this is obviously involves one in solid state physics. It is a subject which is not at all well understood, and I think it lies at the root of the difficulties in making progress with any of these theories. Obviously, if you try and capture the moon, you must have some means of dissipating energy, and the process of dissipation is fundamentally not understood.
One more question, Harry Pease.
Maybe I wasn't paying attention closely enough, but I don't remember a time figure for the period in which the accretion of the moon occurred from the after the rings were formed.
Well, this theory of the accretion of the moon from a sediment ring is not my theory. This is the theory of Oerpics. And Oerpic estimates, this is one he's been in the literature for a long, long time. My side of the part on this is in fact providing an explanation of the chemistry of such the ring and the composition. Oerpic estimates a period of about 100 years for the instability of the instability starts to accrete to form the moon. In the case of the Earth, for the model that I put forward, the accretion time is very, very critical. The Earth has to accrete in a period of from 1 million to 5 million years in order for the model that I've been advocating to be at least a minimum a time less than 5 million years for this model to work.
I think the attractiveness of a theory in which you sort of condense the moon from a dust cloud in the more or less in the equatorial plane of the Earth is that essentially the same process can be used to form the other the satellites of the other planets. And it actually predates Oerpic, and I can't remember the Dutchman's name who wrote a great deal about this between the wars, and his main points were that if you look at the irregularities in the solar system, the fact that the orbits of the planets are in near the plane of the equator of the sun, and you compare that, you draw the analogy with these regularities and those of the satellites around the planets, one is rather led to the view that the same process of accretion must apply in both cases.
Why are there still rings at Saturn?
There's a break between the rings and the satellites of Saturn, just about where the Roche limit predicts that bodies inside that limit are torn apart by the gravitative tidal effects. Beyond that limit, you get satellites, so it fits in beautifully.
Thank you very much, Joe.